Hello, everybody, and welcome to Your Files, Your Taxes, Your Way podcast. My name is Ida Celli, and today's topic for our podcast would be the tax update for 2023. And to speak to us about these updates is our very own Jerry Vitarata. Hi, Jerry. How are you?
How's it going, Ida? How's everything?
Good.
Another tax season, right? Another tax season. So, and tax update, of course, the big one, right? This is the big podcast that we do every single year where we talk about what's new for 2023 tax year specifically. So what's on the plate?
Okay, so we're going to have a couple of topics we're going to talk about, and you're going to explain to us what's the difference this year, all right? So let's start off with the tax-free first home savings account. What is that all about?
Yeah, so that's the big tax change, really. And what the government has done with a tax-free first home savings account is create a new registered account. Registered meaning that any money you place into these accounts will be tax sheltered, just like an RRSP in a TFSA. So similar in concept, but the tax-free first home savings account, or what I'll call now FHSA, it's a mouthful to keep having to say tax-free first home savings account. So I'm just going to say FHSA, make it a lot simpler. The purpose of it is to shelter money, or to put money in a tax sheltered account in order to allow you to have savings to put on a down payment for the purchase of what the government considers as your first home. Now, what does the government consider as a first home? It means that you have not lived in a home that you owned in the last 4 years. So the moment you meet that criteria, you're 18 and over and you're a resident of Canada, you are eligible to create this FHSA. Okay, this account. So there is a limit to how much you can contribute to this account, which is set at $8,000 annually and $40,000 over a lifetime. And the contributions, like an RRSP, are tax deductible, meaning that you reduce your taxable income by the amount of your contribution. Okay, now what happens later on, and remember what I mentioned is that the funds are tax sheltered, meaning that they can accumulate and they accumulate on a tax sheltered basis. The government is not going to charge any tax while the funds are within the account. Now, what happens when you've saved money in this account throughout the years and now you are ready to purchase what the government calls your first home? Again, remember, first home means you haven't lived in a property that you owned in the last 4 years. The moment you're ready to make that withdrawal and your first-time homeowner as of that point of the withdrawal, the kicker is that the withdrawal is tax-free. So you withdraw money from the account and then you put it for the down payment of the purchase of your first home. So the advantage of the FHSA is that it's kind of like the best of both worlds, meaning RRSP and TFSA. On the RRSP side, your contributions are tax deductible. On the withdrawal side, your withdrawal is tax-free, like a TFSA. So that's the advantage. But remember the condition. It has to be for the purchase of a first home. Now, what happens in the case where you don't purchase a first home? We know that in the last several years, prices have gone through the roof, especially in many Canadian cities, many Canadian urban centers. Let's say, you know, you create your FHSA account and you never purchase a first home. Well, in that case, what happens is the account, you're allowed to hold it for at least 15 years. And after the 15th year that you created the account expires, meaning that you would have to then transfer the funds from that account to an RRSP account in that case. So that's the advantage here, is that even if maybe you're not thinking of purchasing a home anytime soon in this case, it's still worthwhile to contribute to an FHSA. Even so, for example, if you are a person who maximizes their RRSP deduction limit every single year and you're eligible for an FHSA, the FHSA becomes kind of like a de facto extension of your RRSP. So even if you have, you know, no intention of buying a home, or if you're not going to buy a home for several years, still worthwhile. If you put money into the FHSA and you never purchase a home, you can simply transfer the money back to an RRSP account without any tax consequence. And the kicker here is that when you transfer those funds back to your RRSP account, it doesn't affect your RRSP room and limit. So that's another advantage of the FHSA. Now we have, you know, of course, there's a lot more conditions that deal with the FHSA. We've written a really detailed blog article on our website on ufile.ca. When you're going to see the description of this video, of this podcast, we're going to post the link to the tax update article. And within that article, we have a link to the detailed FHSA article that explains to you A to Z how this new tax shelter program works.
Quick question for you regarding that, the deduction. Is it like an RSP where you can deduct up to, you can contribute up to 60 days the following year for it to count? Let's say I make my contribution now, can I still apply it for my 2023 tax return?
That's a very good question. And the answer is no. On that end, there it differs from an RRSP. So we know that right now, by the time most will see this podcast, we're still going to be in RRSP season, right? For 2023, which means the first 60 days of 2024. Remember, for everybody who's listening to us right now, the deadline is February 29th, not March 1st. It's a leap year. Don't make that mistake. It's always the first 60 days. So it is February 29th until midnight. Okay, that's your deadline for RRSP. However, I digress. Let's go back to the FHSA. So for the FHSA, it's calendar year. So you had to have already contributed within the calendar year to make it count for that year, meaning that your contributions will be eligible up until December 31st, 2023. Now, another aspect, and it's a great point what you brought up with the contributions. Another aspect that I want to add to this as well is that I mentioned that it's an $8,000 limit every single year, and it's $40,000 cumulative over a lifetime. Okay. Now, the key though is that unlike an RRSP account or even a TFSA account, your limit does not start accumulating until you create an FHSA account, even if you don't fund it. So you have to be very, very careful with that. RRSPs and TFSAs, whether you have accounts in those programs or not, whether you created accounts within those programs or not, your limit is accumulating from the moment you become eligible. So with the RRSP, it's when you start earning income, right? When you start having business income or employment income, okay? It's 18% of that income that becomes your limit. TFSA is the moment you turn 18. The moment you turn 18, you get the flat, which I believe right now it's a set at $7,000 and accumulates every single year, regardless of whether you've created accounts. Not for the FHSA. You must create an account in order to start accumulating your limit. So that's the key. Even if you don't have the funds right away to fund your FHSA account, create your accounts anyways. That way you can start accumulating your room.
Okay. Very interesting. So let's go on to the next topic, is the Canada Workers Benefit.
Yes. So this is not new. I mean, the Canada Workers Benefit has been around for a long time, right? The government has introduced this program. For those of you who don't know what the Canada Workers Benefit is, it is a refundable credit, meaning that whether you are taxable or not, the government's going to basically give you the credit in cash. It doesn't matter whether you are, you know, within the threshold of being taxable, you're still going to get the credit. And it is targeted towards employees and people who have what the government calls working income that are at a lower income level. So essentially what the government is trying to do with the Canada Workers Benefit is to incentivize you to continue working. Okay, so even though you've got a lower income working, it could be somebody who's a student who now graduated and is transitioning into the job market, or somebody, for example, who was on welfare and is now trying to transition into the job market. Okay, so the government is incentivizing you to get into the job market by giving you this tax credit if you have working income and it's a lower income. Now, what the government has done for 2023 is to basically pay you half of that credit that ordinarily you claim on your tax return. They'll pay to you half in advance, and they'll give it to you as a quarterly payment. Okay, that's what they're going to do. Okay, so if you were eligible for the credit for your 2022 tax year, the government's going to give it to you now as a quarterly installment starting, and they did this last year, starting in July 2023, they started paying in advance half the credit you would ordinarily be entitled to as a quarterly payment starting in July. And the last payment was in January of this year. That was the last payment. Okay. Now, of course, remember, this credit is in advance and conditions can change, right? So for example, let's say last year, 2022, you just got into the job market. 2023, you got a promotion. And now you might be making more income than what you were making the year before. And this credit is a progressive credit, meaning the more you make, the less you're going to get of that credit up until you hit a certain threshold and the government cuts you off on that credit. Okay, so it's based on your income. So because the government is estimating, they're giving it to you in advance, they're basing it on your 2022 tax year. But your 2023 could be different. So what the government's going to do is that they're going to send a slip to anybody who received and collected the credit in advance in order to declare it on their tax return to reconcile. And basically by reconciling, meaning they're going to check whether they overpaid you or underpaid you this credit. Okay. And that's what's there's going to be a new calculation on Schedule 6 that's going to show that. Okay. So if they overpaid you, you would pay the difference essentially. Okay. Along those lines. Okay. So what is it? Now the calculation is more convoluted than that, but it's the logic is along those lines. Okay. You have to reconcile between what they gave you in advance and what you're supposed to get based on the calculation tax term. Because again, our situation changes. You know, I graduate 1 year, I just start working, I'm eligible for the Canada Workers Benefit. But if I get a promotion, I might no longer be eligible for that credit. So that's why that reconciliation would come in.
Okay, so it's an improved version of the credit. Right.
Yeah, it's improved in the delivery, right? That's what it is. That instead of waiting to file your tax return by April of the following year, you're getting the credit in advance through quarterly installments. That's essentially what it is.
Okay. Now, I believe this is something a little bit new this year, or it's been modified. It's the residential property flipping rule.
Yes. Yeah, that's an interesting one. That's a really, really interesting one. That's the government trying to patch up the holes in the Income Tax Act. Okay, that's essentially what they're doing in this case. Now, in all honesty, this rule really existed already. It was never written in law, but the government applied it administratively. If they noticed people who were buying and selling houses really quickly, okay, and they did this several times, okay, the government would essentially start auditing these individuals and tell them, look, you have a business. This is not a capital gain. This is not a home that you're living in that your intent was to live in, and all of a sudden you got this fantastic offer to sell it again. Okay, you really have a business. You're a property flipper. So now what the government has done with this rule starting in 2023 is that they've written it in law now. Okay. And what they've done is essentially the rule is if you purchase the residential home and you sell it within 12 months of when you purchased it, okay, you trigger what they call the residential property flipping rule, which is this new rule. Again, we give you all the details in the blog article, which we're going to post the link in the description of this podcast. Okay. And what the rule is essentially, ordinarily, when you sell a residential property, okay, and it's a taxable residential property that you have to declare, then at that point, it is a taxable capital gain, meaning that 50% of the profit that you make off that sale becomes taxable income. So 50% is exempt, 50% is taxable income. That's ordinarily how capital gains work, okay? But when you trigger this rule, what the government is doing is saying, you know what? This isn't a residential property anymore. This is an inventory item in a business. And when that happens, when it's inventory in a business, guess what? When you sell and you make a profit on an inventory item, it's no longer a capital gain. It's a sale from an inventory. And that the profits from that you have to include at 100%, not 50% that you ordinarily would for capital gain. Let's do an example, okay? Just understand the concept. You know, I purchase a home. Okay, for $200,000, and I purchase it in the middle of the hot market that we saw between 2020 and 2022. Okay, I get an offer right when I move in and the person says, hey, you know what? You know, I want to get this property. I'm going to give you $100,000 more. So within a couple of weeks, I make $100,000. Okay, so they give me $300,000 to take the home away from me. Now, the example is overly simplistic because now a lot of people are going to sit there and tell me, where the hell are you going to find a property of $300,000 in Canada? Right? I mean, you know, that's a unicorn. You know, I mean, that's a total unicorn, you know? Let's not kid ourselves. But, you know, just bear with me. I'm just trying to simplify the numbers. Okay, so we understand the concept. All right? So I sell it to this person for $300,000. I make a quick $100,000. Ordinarily, I would be taxed on 50% of that $100,000. That's what we call the capital gains inclusion rate. So when you make a capital gain, whether you're selling stocks, whether you're selling bonds, you know, whether you're selling mutual funds and you make a profit, only 50 from a taxable account, only 50% of the profits are taxable. So you declare that as income. So in my example, I would be declaring $50,000 additional income. But the problem is I sold it within 12 months in 2023. Okay. So now I trigger this new rule. And what that means is that that $100,000, not only is it no longer a capital gain, but it is a sale of an inventory, which means that the $100,000 profit that I made is fully included in my income now. It's no longer $50,000, it's $100,000 that I have to declare. And not only that, I have declared as business income. Okay. And that's an important distinction because when I sell it as business income, now that income is subject to other contributions that I have to make. Not only do I pay tax on it, but I also have to contribute, for example, to CPP, to the Canada Pension Plan, because now it is an additional income and I have to pay the employer-employee portion. All of us pay CPP from our employment income. Whoever's employed right now watching this, we know this. We make contributions to the CPP plan, what's called directly. Okay. We make contributions to the CPP plan directly from our pay, and our employer kicks in the equivalent amount. But when you're self-employed, there's no employer. You're the employer, you're the employee, which means you pay both. Okay, you have to pay both the employer-employee portion of CPP on top of it, on top of paying the tax. So it's very, very penalizing what the government is doing. Now, like I said, they've been applying this rule for many years, administratively, they've been doing this. Now they've written it in the act now. Now it's official. There's no wiggling your way out of it. There's just a few, but there are exceptions to the rule. And the exceptions are, for example, there's a death, for example, you moved because you had a new employment, you moved because you need to house a relative and you needed a bigger home, for example, a divorce is an example. In order to settle the divorce, you had to sell your property within 12 months. Another example is a bankruptcy. That's another example as well. And these are all exceptions to this rule. So the moment you meet that exception, then the property is still considered as a real estate property and becomes capital gain instead of business income. The other penalizing factor of this is that because the government no longer considers, let's say you don't fall under the exceptions that I just named. Let's say you don't meet one of those. Okay. But you could say, but you know what? I lived in it, right? I mean, even it was, let's say 2 months, I still lived in it, which means I could claim it as a principal residence and I could exempt myself from it. Doesn't work. Doesn't work. Why? Because what the government is doing, and they've written it cleverly in the act, what they've done is they've changed the designation of the property. It is no longer a real estate property, it is inventory. So you can't claim a principal residence exemption on inventory. It's no longer real estate property. So therefore, they disqualify you from the principal residence exemption as well. So yeah, the government really, really penalized these individuals. And it makes sense because when you look at how the prices just flew from the pandemic all the way till the interest rate hikes, okay, a lot of these individuals were flipping properties and simply declaring them as capital gains. Okay, and the government's simply trying to crack down on them.
Okay, do you have that kind of cash?
Oh, I wish. Well, again, I would love to close my eyes right now and dream of that $300,000 home that exists in Canada, you know, the real estate property. I think I called a unicorn here. You know, I don't think it exists at all. But anyways.
All right. Moving on. The next topic is the multi-generational home renovation tax credit. That's yes. Something new, or it's an extension of something that was there already.
No, you might be thinking of the old renovation tax credit that happened during the 08 crash, right? When we had the Great Recession, as it's called, right? I believe that's what it's commonly called. When the Great Recession happened, there was the home renovation tax credit at the time where you could claim up to $10,000 of expenses for renovations. It was temporary. It was a temporary measure that was only there, I think, for a year or two, if memory serves me, and then they scrapped it. This one is different because it's a little bit stricter in the criteria, but much bigger limit in what you can claim. And on top of it, it is a refundable credit, which, like I mentioned, with a Canada workers benefit, even if you're not taxable on your tax return, they'll still give you the credit in cash. That's essentially what a refundable credit means. Okay. So the multi-generational home renovation tax credit, it's great news really, because when we see the housing market again and how it exploded and how it became, you know, how the prices just became ridiculous, the government really responded well to that. And essentially what it is If you as a caregiver decide to house what the government calls a qualifying individual, in other words, your relative, okay, and we'll see in a minute what that, you know, who the eligible relative is, and you decide to renovate your home to create what the government calls a secondary unit or dwelling. So you're creating a second home within your home is essentially what you're creating, okay? When you have renovation expenses to do that, the government's going to give you this credit, which is the multi-generational home renovation tax credit, okay? Now, the credit itself is capped at $50,000. So you can claim up to $50,000 of renovation expenses, and you can claim 15% of those eligible renovation expenses. Now, who's the relative that you have to house? Okay, who can claim the credit? Can it be the relative that you're housing, or is it only the caregiver that takes the credit? The answer is both. Both the relative that you're housing and the caregiver who's gonna house this individual can claim the credit. Because what can happen in these scenarios is it is the relative's home and the caregiver will come and move in, right? And will come and move in and then basically create the secondary unit in order to house the relative. So in either case, both can claim as long as they prove that they live together and one of them at the very least owns the home. Okay, that's the key to be able to claim the credit. Right now, what does the government consider? Now, who are these eligible relatives? Who is this person that as a caregiver you would have to house? It has to be either somebody who is 65 years of age and older, or somebody who is an adult, 18 and over, and is eligible for the disability tax credit. So they are disabled, essentially. Okay, as long as it's those two individuals, and the relative has to be, you know, what's called what we call a non-arm's length relative, meaning that it has to be somebody very close to you in blood relation. It's got to be your mom, your dad, your grandparents, your children, your brother, your sister, your uncle, your aunt, your niece, your nephew. Those are the relatives that it has to be one of those relatives, a blood relation, not necessarily blood relation, though it could be from adoption too, but it has to be one of those types of relatives in order to be eligible to claim the credit. Now, the other catch is the fact that you have to create a secondary dwelling or a secondary unit, okay, within the home, meaning it has to have its own private entrance, it has to have a bedroom, it has to have a kitchen, and it has to have a bathroom. That's the catch, okay, that it really has to be a secondary dwelling, another home, in other words, with its own private entrance. That's the key. As long as you meet that criteria and your renovations are for the creation of this kind of unit and for the housing of the relative that I mentioned before, you are eligible now for this credit. And it's a great credit, up to $50,000 of expenses, and you're claiming 15% of those expenses as a credit, okay? Now, from there, The renovation expenses have to be enduring in nature, what the government calls enduring in nature, meaning it can't just be, you know, just a paint job, right? It's got to be, you know, fundamental renovations that you're making to the home. And it can't be anything related to maintenance. And you can't, for example, deduct furniture that you put into the home. That's not eligible. It has to be really, you know, a construction project is what it has to be. And the year you can claim that credit is the year that the work has been finalized, that the work has been completed. So for example, if let's say I start the renovations in November 2023 and they end in March 2024, I can only claim the credit in 2024 when the work is completed. And it's once in a lifetime that you can claim this credit. Meaning that let's say you create the secondary unit, 10 years later, you decide to sell and move to another home and you want to create another secondary unit for your eligible relative, doesn't work. Okay, you cannot claim because it's only once in a lifetime.
If the credit is still available then.
Absolutely. As we saw with the renovation tax credit, it didn't stay very long. So we'll see how long the government is gonna leave it. Absolutely.
All right. Is there any changes to the tradesperson's tools expense deduction?
Yes. So that's a very, very minor change in the sense that the government is extending, is basically doubling the limit that you can claim for a tools expense. For those of you who don't know what this means, so basically picture a tradesperson, whether it's a plumber, an electrician, something along those lines. A mechanic, for example, would be another example of a tradesperson. So these individuals can deduct the cost of tools that they have to pay out of pocket, okay, that their employer has not reimbursed them for. And this is actually very common. Especially with mechanics, is very common that you would see. That's why mechanics actually get a second deduction on the tax return for their expenses, while other tradespeople only get one, which is the tradesperson tool expenses. Now, the government will cap what you can claim as a deduction for the cost of the tools that they paid out of pocket. Normally it was $500. Now the government has extended it to $1,000. Okay, so they essentially doubled the limit for that tool's deduction.
Okay, now the big one.
Yes.
That everybody wants to know. Home office expense, the flat rate method. Does that still exist?
Drum roll, it's gone. So there you go. So Ida, you know, the point that you brought up with the multi-generational is so valid because, again, you just never know when the government is just going to pull the rug, you know, and say, forget it. They're just going to pull the plug and say, that's it. So when it comes to home office expenses, the government during the pandemic, starting 2020 all the way up to 2022, they introduced a new deduction, a new way, actually. Sorry, the deduction was existing, but it's a new way of computing home office expenses, which was called the flat rate method, right? So as long as you're required to work from home for more than 50% of the time due to the pandemic, okay, then you're entitled to a $2 per workday deduction as a home office expense deduction on your tax return, meaning you're deducting these expenses directly off of your net income. Okay, so that's essentially what the government allowed. I felt it was a great program because of the fact that you didn't have to go through the regular administrative requirements that people who were already working from home before the pandemic had to go through in order to claim their home office expenses, which was, number one, they needed a certificate from their employer, which you call the conditions of employment, which is the T2200 form, where the employer had to sign off telling the government that this employee had to work from home for more than 50% of the time. Okay. The second red tape was essentially you had to itemize your expenses. You had to keep your receipts, and then you were able to deduct your rent. You were able to deduct your electricity, your utilities. You were able to deduct your home internet and some supplies. Okay, you were allowed to deduct, but of course you were limited to the percentage, the square footage of your home office vis-a-vis the square footage of your home. So, for example, if your home office represented 10% of your home space, then you're only entitled to 10% of those expenses. So, as you can see, it was quite lengthy as far as what had to be done in order to claim home office expenses. The flat rate method did away with all that. The flat rate method said, look, are you required to work from home more than 50% of the time due to the pandemic? Perfect. Claim $2 per workday. That's it. No certificate, no convoluted calculations with measuring tapes to measure, you know, how big your home office is and then measuring the rest of your home, et cetera. You didn't have to do any of that. Unfortunately, the government has done away with that. And now we're back to the old program or what the government had called the detailed method, where you have to now claim, you know, each expense, you know, have proof of those expenses, keep your receipts handy in case you get audited by the CRA. And then again, you're only claiming based on the square footage of your home, and you need the certificate from your employer in order to be able to claim them. Unfortunately, it's the unfortunate reality.
Well, we knew it was a temporary fix for the moment. So quickly, what are the changes for the province of Quebec? That's the only one that has to be a separate tax return is done.
Yes. Okay, so the change for Quebec is, number one, the two first tax brackets have been reduced by 1%. Okay, mm-hmm. So for example, when you made income, your first $49,000 of income was taxed at 15%. Now it will be taxed at 14%. And then the next $49,000, which would reach almost $90,000, almost $100,000 actually, almost $98,000. And change almost $50,000 would be taxed at 20%. Now it will be taxed at 19%. So that's the big change. Now you probably won't see a big effect on your tax return because in theory you should see the effect because, for example, if you hit the second tax bracket, let's say you make $60,000, well, you already have a tax savings of almost $500, right? It's 1% of the first $50,000. You're already saving $500. But the thing is, your payroll taxes should already have reflected this. So in July, your employer was supposed to reduce the payroll taxes they were deducting from you for your employment income. So you won't see a big effect, but yeah, hey, you were getting more money though during the year since July. So that's great news for everybody. Now, the next thing to mention about Quebec is the residential property flipping rule. Same rule in Quebec. All right. So it's exactly the same. So they're going to apply the same rules with the federal date. Again, you sell your home within 12 months, you're triggering this rule. And now it is business income included at 100% instead of 50% of a capital gain. So exactly the same rule as on the federal side.
Great. And I think that recaps our update for our tax update for 2023.
So that was a mouthful. Yeah.
So any quick last words?
Very simply put, everything that we spoke about today with a lot more detail, because of course our format doesn't allow us to go through all this kind of detail for all these measures. So all these things are located on our website, which is at ufile.ca. Simply go to the tips and tricks tab, just hover over it, and then you're going to see the UFile blog. What we spoke about in this session, in this podcast, we will provide a link directly to that blog article where you're going to have all the details that you need in order to be able to maximize your tax return and be able to benefit from these measures that the government has announced. But again, our website is a treasure trove of information when it comes to taxes. Go to our UFile blog. Once you go to our blog, you simply go one back and you'll see all of our blog articles where we write about a lot of interesting topics. The other thing that we do as well, we produce a lot of YouTube videos where we try to educate you about different things about taxes. For example, this podcast on YouTube and also in audio, for example, on Google Podcast, on Apple Music, on all your favorite podcast platforms. It's all there. On UFile, we also do how-to videos within the software. So how do we claim these credits? For example, we're going to have some of these new tax measures. We're actually going to show you how-to videos on YouTube to show you how to claim these amounts. Or if you're subject, for example, to property flipping rule, how do you trigger it in the software, for example? So all these resources are there for you. We do it free. We just give it away. We're just giving all that information away. So take advantage of it and go ahead and maximize your tax returns.
All right. So that concludes our podcast for today. Thank you very much, Jerry. And I'll see you next time.
Thank you, Ida. Take care, everybody.